It's Monday, October 18th, 2010. This is Philosophy 201 Ethics. And today we were beginning with egoism. So to begin with, there's a section of the text on psychological versus ethical egoism. That will be probably the first question on the next exam, not this upcoming exam, but the next exam. So I want to chime in on that. What's the difference between psychological egoism?
Egoism.
Maybe something that hasn't spoken before. We hear from, I'm sure we'll have things that the usual suspects will want to chime in. This is a fairly easy one if you've done the reading or have something to tell us to say about anybody. Maybe hasn't spoken before or want to chime in here? Okay, I'll throw it open to everybody. Yes, sir.
Psychological egoism says there's no such thing as altruism. You can't do some things if you have against your heart.
Okay, a little bit louder, please. Project from the diaphragm.
There's no such thing as altruism or doing something just out of goodness of your heart. You're only doing it to make yourself feel good or to do something good for yourself.
I'm sure no, but let me just repeat that for people listening on the podcast. So, psychological egoism says there's no such thing as altruism, and what is that altruism? Can an egoist do a charitable act? So, no such thing as altruism. So we should define altruism. Altruism is often seen as the opposite of egoism. So what is altruism? It's doing something for the sake of another. So, for example, and you can have typically people think you have two kinds of motives for doing something. One would be a selfish motive. I did this because, what would be an example of a selfish act? Or have some... How about something that's necessarily not necessarily bad?
Okay.
I took a job reviewing a textbook, and I got a $200 honorarium, right? And suppose my reason for doing that is I wanted the $200, and maybe I might have a side reason that might be like something like, well, and the book looked kind of interesting to me. So I figured I could make $200 and learn something about philosophy. And suppose maybe I had a third reason I wanted to further my career by having my name in the introduction as a person who contributed to the editing of the book. So I actually done these things. You look at there's a Hurley Logic book that my name's in there someplace in the 7th edition or something. So those would all be, you know, self-interested reasons. Now, what would be like an altruistic reason I might review a textbook? Yeah?
To contribute your knowledge to the learning of people.
Yeah, I want to make sure that the book is the best it can be. And it may be, suppose there's no honorary involved, right? Imagine they're not even going to pay me for it. And suppose that the book is like a dry logic book, like that Hurley book actually wasn't that fun to review. But suppose it's a friend of mine. So a friend of mine is coming out with his new logic book, and he really wants an honest opinion from someone who has experience with logic and knows the books that are out there. And having reviewed the main logic textbooks and done a comparison study between the two, I would be the perfect person to review it. So what I might do is I might just do it as a favor to my friend to help him. And that would be a typical altruistic act. And so altruism is doing something not for yourself, doing something for someone else. And it, the altruism has to do with the motive and not the act. So it's the reason why you did it. So there's no such thing as an altruistic act per se. There are only altruistic motives. Define by motive. What's a motive? The reason you perform an act. So an act is, you know, you do something like saving a drowning child. You might have two different motives, or you might have a bunch of different motives mixed in. Suppose you hate kids, and this kid in particular, like you really hate this kid, and you don't care about one way or another, but you know that his family are rich and that you could get a reward and get on TV and people will think you're a hero if you save this kid. And you see there's people around that nobody's jumping in to save the kid because he's like way out there and you just happen to be a really good swimmer. So you go out there and save the kid and you come back on the shore and pretty soon the TV crews show up there, you know, and you're smiling with the kid and the mother's thanking you and you get your picture in the paper. If that's your, and that's what you planned all along, if that's your only reason for doing that, that would be, you're helping someone, but you're doing it for a selfish motive. Now, an altruistic motive would be, there's a child in need, I don't want that child to drown, I'm going to even risk my own life, why? For his sake, to save him. I don't expect heavenly reward. I don't expect to get my picture in the paper. And maybe if the press comes snooping around, want to interview me, I just might, you know, turn them away and say, I'm not interested in talking to them. Maybe I eschew publicity for my magnanimous act. So that would be an altruistic act. Now, psychological egoism says no such animal. There's no such thing as an altruistic act. That everything, and another way of putting this is saying, all acts are selfish. That all acts stem from selfish motives. Even those motives where you, even those cases where you appear to be acting for the sake of another person, you have some secret selfish motive. And the reason you help anyone is not, it ultimately comes back to you're helping yourself in some way. You want heavenly reward. You want to avoid guilt feelings. You want people to think well of you. You get warm, fuzzy sensations when you help people. Those sorts of things. So what do you think? Does it seem like a plausible view, implausible view? Cynical, realistic, Evan?
I have to say I subscribe to that kind of idealism for a while, but like, I was reading the criticisms, and, you know, I started thinking about it, and one of the first criticisms was that it's an unfalsifiable claim. Mm-hmm. And I personally changed my view because of that, and I was like, yeah, that is unfalsifiable. And if you have a view that's unfalsifiable, then, you know, how are you going to confirm whether it's true or false? So.
Yeah, like, if you can't imagine, think about how would you prove this theory is wrong? If this is indeed an empirical theory, it masquerades as an empirical theory, right? It says if you look at every act, the evidence, you'll find some evidence that it's a selfish act. But is it really an empirical theory? Or is it a theory that no possible evidence could disprove? Yeah.
I'll try one. Example, an atheist jumping on the gurney to save another person.
Uh-huh.
An atheist, so no further reward. Jumping on the grenade, he's going to be dead because he's not going to be fooled about himself or anything else. It's a split second decision, so you don't really like get to wallow how awesome you are or like, you know, get any output from people uh-huh. surrounding you. You see a grenade, you jump on it, you're an atheist, you have no family. So there's nothing, I cannot see anything but altruism in that specific
case. Why would an atheist jump on a grenade?
It happened many times.
Blake?
Let's say that his decision to do so is the reaction. He's already experienced the reward. The camaraderie of his squad mates, the time they spent together, he's already garnered those feelings from being around them. And so his decision to do that is a reaction. Like you said, there's no thought. It's not. It's neither a selfish nor a selfless act. It's just a reaction. He's already experienced, you know, the positive effect, and so this is the outcome of that.
No, because most people are not going to do that, so I don't see the, you know.
I mean, how is it altruistic if he doesn't even think about his decision?
He does. He's like, oh, it's like, it's a split second. It's not enough to get reactions from other people to make your fuzzy even perform. But I mean, yes, like, grenade, those guys going to die, I'm going to do this. You know, you still think about it. I mean, it's like, it's not reaction rate grenade. Everybody just jumps up to jump on it. You know, it's you still have time to think and realize what you're doing.
Uh-huh.
It's not.
Yeah.
I would say that you have to take the military out of that context because he's conditioned to react impulsively for the betterment of the troop. So it may not have been his decision. He may have been conditioned to kick it in.
Oh, I'm totally taking it out of context. I'm using the context of World War II where where the non-troops were fighting. I mean, we're talking about civilians.
So you have a civilian, like, should I be saving a bunch of soldiers then? Is that your
soldiers,
example?
Soldiers, troops, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, yeah.
I would say in the sense that if it were a soldier and also sort of goes into the space line, like I said.
What about one person just saving another person, like sacrificing their life? Like actually, there was a case of some rafters and somebody fell in the water not wearing a life jacket, and I think they were going around at night in a boat or something stupid, and one boat ran aground and was sinking. Another boat tried to save them and they ran aground too. At the end of the day, a bunch of people drowned, but people in the second boat drowned trying to save the people in the first boat. And the question is like, why would you do that if you were selfish? It would seem like that would be an act of altruism. But then, what's the egoist going to say about this? The psychological egoist, yeah.
That they may have had selfish motives; they were just unsuccessful in completing the act.
Yeah, maybe they. Now, what might be a selfish motive in trying to save some fellow voters?
When the guilt, they die.
Yeah, imagine, like, what would the opposite be? Like, you see some people saying, help, help. You know, they're like, and they're flailing around the water, and you're sitting there like that. You'd be haunted every night for the rest of your life to think, oh, I could have saved them, but I did nothing. I was paralyzed by fear, or I was worried about what would happen to me. I'm such a bad person. You'd have, like, a lifetime of guilt, right? Or maybe you... you think about that, you have sympathy for them, and so you feel like you should help, and you feel this sort of sense of empathy or sympathy for them, and you want to help them. Well, you want to help them, that's a desire, right? It's a desire on your part, and aren't desires essentially selfish, right? You want to help them. Why? Because you feel guilty if you don't. You feel a certain affinity with them as fellow boaters. And so you feel in some sense that when they die, you're going to feel pain, and helping them is going to bring you pleasure. Well, trying to avoid pain and get pleasure, isn't that selfish motivation? I think that's what the egos would say. Now, how about the other side of that? So, is that... Now, think about some other act. Could you think of take Mother Teresa, right? Mother Teresa, who helped the poor in Calcutta for her whole life and sacrificed herself. Was she just going for heavenly reward, or you think you talk to her and she says she's motivated for love and compassion for other people? And people say, oh, that just means what? That she wanted to help other people, and so she helped them, and she got a lot of pleasure from helping other people. And so that was her reward. And she's just as selfish as somebody else who gets pleasure from robbing little old ladies and hitting them over the head and taking a purse. It's just that people derive pleasure from different things. So what do you think about that as an argument? I think that's what the ego is going to say. Every time you're going on desire, you're acting selfishly. Every time, and that doesn't really matter whether the desires concern other people or not. You're trying to get those pleasurable sensations, and that's what motivates people trying to get pleasure or avoid pain. if you think about these cases, it seems like the egoist is always going to have an answer. And that is to hit on this unfalsifiable objection. That's sort of one objection. Unfalsifiable. You would think that not being able to prove something wrong is a virtue, but actually it turns out to be something, a vice. It turns out to be bad. Because if there's no possible evidence that could prove a theory wrong, then it's not really saying anything. It's just like if I said, all objects are hot, right? Well, how would you prove, you know? You say, well, what about an ice cube? I said, well, in comparison to absolute zero, an ice cube is hot, right? Or think about some of these conspiracy theories, right? So you have people who say things like, the Jews control the media. You say, well, what about Rupert Murdoch? He's not a Jew, and he's, you know, owns News Corp and the Wall Street Journal. Well, they need a few Gentile puppets, otherwise people get wise to their schemes. Right? So every time you bring up an objection, there's some like adjustment made in the theory so it holds together. And after a while, you start to think that this is just kind of a presupposition and that no evidence is going to convince this person of the contrary. And there's no possible evidence that could disprove it. So to be a significant theory, it has to be possible, at least in principle, to conceive of some evidence that might prove it wrong. And you can do this with any scientific theory. You can imagine, if you can find a case, or if you can imagine a case which might prove it wrong, it shows that it's okay as a scientific theory. I think of some example. Can you think of an example of a scientific theory that you might, how you might prove it's wrong? There's some that are pretty well established. It's hard to think of something, but... Well, what about the idea that heavy objects and light objects fall at the same rate, right? So it's actually true that if you take away air drag, if I take a 50-pound boulder of the same size and shape as something which is like hollow, like a hollow sphere, and I make sure they exactly have the same shape and same surface. Say I have like a styrofoam boulder, which is contoured the same way. If I drop both those objects, they're going to hit the ground at the same time because gravity doesn't care whether one's heavy or one's light. But you can think of an experiment, right? If I took two heavy really heavy object and really light object, and I dropped them, and the light object landed last, the heavy object went really fast, and the light object went slower, that might show there's something wrong with the theory. You could conceive of an experiment which would disprove it. But it seems that you can't think about some other examples, like historical example. Like, I know Caesar crossed the Rubicon 43 BC. If you find in an inscription that says Caesar slept here, you know, 43 BC, and it lists like the day, and it's like on the other side of the Roman Empire, or there's evidence that Caesar had an illness which kept him bedridden for 10 months, and that he never could have gotten to the Rubicon. So, I mean, you can imagine historical evidence which would show that that didn't actually happen, contrary to historians. But it seems that you can't imagine any evidence that would show that altruism is possible under egoism. So this is kind of a subtle point. And this is true of like a lot of pseudoscience, that there's no way to disconfirm them. There's no possible way to disconfirm the theory. Shows it's not a real scientific theory, but a pseudoscientific theory. So this is one major objection to egoism. And there's a couple others, psychological egoism. There's a couple others mentioned in the text. I think there's also a distinction between having a desire. All desire is not selfish. That even though you get pleasure from something, is that really the reason why you do it? Like I might help someone, and after I help that person, I might feel good about it. But is that the reason why I help them? It seems that the reason why I help other people is because I want to help them, and I'm doing it for their sake. I'm not saying, oh, look, if I help that little lady across the street, I'm going to get some warm, fuzzy feelings. And I love warm, fuzzy feelings. That's not what goes through your head, right? You're like, oh, that poor little old lady, I got to help her across the street because otherwise she might get run over or fall down or something. So I think, oh, I'll go help her. I don't think, oh, some warm fuzzy feelings. That sounds like a good idea. I love producing those warm fuzzy feelings. So although those are a side effect of helping people, and if you're normal, unless you're a psychopath or something, that's not the reason why you do it. The reason why you do it is to help that other person. I think, although some people argue for psychological egoism, I think there's a lot of powerful objections to it, and I don't find it very convincing, but your mileage may vary. You might think, well, I'm not sure what you'd say about the falsifiable. If anybody has thoughts on either of these. One final thing, unselfish. Selfish has no meaning if there are no unselfish acts. So selfish, the word selfish, has no meaning. If there are no unselfish acts. Or, you know, motivations, I guess. Unselfish acts means acts motivated by, and we just clear, acts motivated by unselfish motives. Acts with unselfish. Acts with unselfish motives. Thoughts? Yes, sir.
I'm a little bit curious. I mean, if by some stretch of the imagination psychological egoism was true, there was no such thing as being selfless, and then by default that would mean there was no such thing as selfish, I mean, that could still work, right? I mean, it would just mean we'd have to redefine our terms on what selfish and selfless means.
Right. Okay, so how would you do that?
Well, you just would have to find a way of defining things like, instead of it being selfish or selfless, it could be more to your benefit, less to your benefit. It doesn't necessarily have to be on one side or the other.
So why wouldn't you just say that an act where you're... So you're saying every act would be self-motivated, but those selfish acts which happen to have... Which happened to bring you pleasure by helping other people, those would be your unselfish acts. Or they would be, those would be altruistic acts, but they'd still be selfish?
I mean, it just seems like it would be a way of eliminating, you know, things that have connotation about them. I mean, if you couldn't say somebody was being selfish, or you couldn't say someone was being selfless, you'd have to find another rationale for evaluating them.
Right, that's true. But the moral connotation might sort of drop away. It seems psychologically unrealistic to me too that if you think about what goes through your mind when you're thinking about helping someone, usually when people give examples like this, they give examples of other people, not themselves, right? They're like, oh, you just did that because blah, 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 blah. But when they think about what they do, and when they help people, they don't think, oh, I'm just a selfish bastard, and I help people because I want to get something out of it. On a reward or whatever. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, how can we decide if something's unselfish? Like, wouldn't it seem subjective? Like, it might seem to somebody else you're being unselfish, but like subconsciously you could still be being selfish. You know, like, I mean, even if like in the case of like helping a friend move, you might have other things to do. You know, you might want to go watch the game at home, but you might decide, you know, I want to help my friend move because. Maybe next time I move, it'll help me. Or you have these subconsciously you're thinking these things, but you might help them, and he thinks you're being unselfish by helping him when he knows you could be at home. But
right.
I think sometimes it's like we don't even know we're being selfish, but we really have these ulterior motives that like place in the back of our minds. I think sometimes it's like still selfish in nature. So part of me thinks like psychological egoism is true in a lot of cases, but then when it comes to the, is there such thing as like selfishness if there's no unselfish act.
Yeah, so you make a good point that it's important to distinguish psychological egoism from just the view that most people are selfish or most of the time. Psychological egoism is a kind of an absolute view that says all acts are self-motivated. So there, if you can find even one act that's selfless or unselfish, or if you think there are only certain individuals who are selfless, and it'd be people like Jesus and Mother Teresa and, you know, and Albert Schweitzer and the big humanitarians, then that's a different view than psychological egoism, which says that all acts are selfish. To me, it doesn't seem to be an empirical view. It seems to be an analytic view, right? A view that all acts are selfish by definition, that all acts are motivated by desire, desires are selfish, therefore all acts are selfish. Yeah.
What about the irrational madman, someone saying, somebody makes that does things because for no other reason than he's compelled to.
Yeah, I guess we could say that we're talking about like sort of deliberative actions that are made, rational choices. So we you might have a separate theory about like, you know, people that are mentally ill or something whose minds aren't working right. Although some ethical egoists tend to think about altruists as being mentally ill in some way or psychologically disturbed. And the same thing is actually true of altruists looking at egoists. Some altruists look at egoists as being psychopaths, essentially. That they don't have a proper moral sense, they don't understand their obligation to other people, and so they think there must be something wrong with you if you don't want to serve the greater good, if you don't think that you need to spend a significant amount of your time going around helping people in need. If you put yourself first, there's something wrong with your brain, or you're a morally corrupt person. And Ayn Rand argues strenuously against this. I thought we'd start out with a story about capitalism. Ayn Rand was once asked, what is your philosophy? And she said essentially about her and her group, we're radicals for capitalism. And so there was a story in the news about these Chilean miners, which probably a lot of you heard about. So I got a little video here from Dan Henninger talking about how the rescue of the Chilean miners was a victory for capitalism.
Holy crap.
People usually say that when they send the messages.
Facebook.
Yeah, lots of Facebook stuff. Here you can see all my emails here.
Where is that?
We're about to turn on a spam filter.
So I have a spam folder.
Maybe you should check those. That's the whole thing.
Do you have somebody just look through this?
I do look through this. Do the thing to make this thing bigger.
Pop-up player,
yeah. Somebody dim the lights in front here too. Yeah. That just gives me a little tiny window. It's not very helpful.
I think you can maximize that.
Can I just like draw a bigger thing? It's not making the window any bigger. I'll just leave it in. I'll just leave it be. Make sure you have all the room here.
Oh.
Oh, okay. The hell? That's what I didn't want to click on. There we go. Sure. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah.
bring in the partners to be on it.
For 100 years, people who know BDO.
Free trade is saving the Chilean miners. Welcome to Opinion Journal Live. We're following this wonderful rescue in Chile, and here to talk about it is our Mary Anastasia O'Grady, our America's columnist. Mary, thanks for being here. Dan Hennier, the Wonderland columnist.
Great.
This is in the Americas. You have to get a sense of wonder watching what's happening there, Dan. What do you take away from it when you watch what is so far a hugely successful effort to rescue these miners?
Well, James, at the risk of being too confrontational for people, I would be willing to call this an enormous victory for free market capitalism. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, if you've been following the reporting over the past 10 days or so, especially in this paper, there have been some remarkable descriptions of the technology that the Chileans imported to use on this. The drill bit, which was the only drill bit apparently in the world that was capable of getting down 2,100 feet to them, comes from a little company called Castle Rock in Berlin, Pennsylvania. 74 employees, okay? The cable that's pulling them up is made in Germany. The fiber optic cable that was snaked down there to show them was made in Japan. They're using Samsung projectors on cell phones to project these pictures up to the top. This can only happen in an economy that is incredibly vibrant and creating new technologies constantly. Chile has completely opened itself to that world, and it all came together out there in that desert to bring these men up from half mile down.
This is probably the best case, the most dramatic case you can think of to promote free trade. And as we know, politicians have a hard time promoting that idea. We saw a recent Wall Street Journal poll, Americans are not sold on free trade. But looking at this, not just the material, but the people from America and elsewhere coming into Chile, it's just amazing watching them work. You talked about one man who's an American who's become a folk hero in Chile.
That was Dale Hart, the 40-year-old operator from Denver who actually was operating the drill when it broke through. He's now become a folk hero in Chile. But, you know, as Mary has written frequently for our paper, the Chileans, unlike, say, Venezuela or Bolivia or Ecuador, have completely opened themselves to this world. A lot of this innovation came out of Chile, right? And it's the Chileans themselves who have to claim the victory here.
And Mary, this does contrast a bit in terms of the Chilean response with, for example, President Obama's response to the Gulf oil spill.
Yeah, I think that what you have in Chile is a president who was once an executive of a very large corporation, LEN Chile. He knows how to take charge and he knows how to execute. And the other thing about Sebastián Piñera is that he was willing to take risks. He was at the inauguration of Manuel Santos in Colombia when this collapse occurred. He immediately got on a plane and flew to Copiapó, which is, you know, the city where the mine is. He was advised not to do that because the mine was a private company. It wasn't a government-owned company. And people said that if he went there and, you know, the miners didn't get out, that he would be tagged with this failure. And he took that risk. He went there. He immediately began working on the kinds of things Dan's talking about, bringing in the expertise that was needed to try to locate the miners. That took almost 2 weeks. And then, of course, once they found out that they were alive, they had this enormous task of trying to get them. And I think, you know, as Dan said, that he was able to organize and execute that because of his leadership skills.
That's right, and we should contrast the effort to bring in talent and expertise from all over the world with in the United States. As people look at the Gulf spill now, it's good to see it's not as bad as some people feared. But we did have this issue with the Jones Act, basically keeping out foreign ships from possibly helping the cleanup in the Gulf.
Yeah, remember we had a huge foreign ship that was being offered that had the incredible capacity to sweep up oil. The Dutch, especially, are apparently the world's leaders in cleaning up oil spills. They, too, were pushed away by the Obama government. You know, I would even include the disaster of Katrina as well. That was a self-contained thing here. Some of us were writing at the time, like, it was a monumental disaster from the hurricane. Why not bring in the private sector and its distribution capabilities, Staples and Target and so forth? People laughed at that, but that is precisely what the Chileans have done with this rescue, is bring the private sector to bear with the best technologies, the best minds available to save these people. And why the United States keeps the private sector at arm's length like that is a mystery.
Well, actually, one way to solve that mystery is to look at who was behind the Jones Act and who wanted to keep foreign ships out. I mean, the Jones Act basically says that if a ship is not made in the United States, it cannot go from one U.S. port to another. It could go from the U.S. out to Haiti and come back, but it can't go around the area in New Orleans. And that's basically a union rule in order to keep shipbuilding in the United States.
Now, last thing, getting back to President Piñera, we were fortunate, Mary, that you hosted a meeting with him here recently, and this was before all the miners started coming out, but certainly there was that confidence. Now, looking back, are you thinking this is because he really was hands-on and understood the problem, or he just felt like that's what the country needed at the time to project that that confidence that it would work out?
It was probably a combination of the two. You know, as I said, he's somewhat of a risk-taker. But I think it was impossible, you know, to be in Chile in the last 2 months and not be somewhat, you know, connected to the miners and the miner story. In fact, when he came to see us, he reached into his pocket and pulled out the original note that the miners had sent up when they made contact with them, saying that they were, all three of them were still alive. And, you know, he had it in a little sort of Ziploc baggie, and you could see that it was really, had personally become something very important to him.
That's right. Thanks, Mary. Thanks, Dan. Great story in Chile. Hope you enjoyed watching it, and please come back tomorrow and every day at noon Eastern for a penny.
Let me get the lights in the back. So that stuff wasn't directly right. I think that the part I wanted you to pay attention to was the part at the beginning. So Dan Henninger points out that the drill bit, which drilled through hundreds of feet of rock to get to these miners, was produced by this small little company in Colorado that has 74 employees. And it's free market capitalism and the innovation that comes with that, which produces things of value to other people. Now, the question is, why do those people in Colorado, or how do they come up with the drill bit? And I think what Dan Henninger's point is that they want to make money. They have the profit motive. And now it happens that because they wanted to make money in drilling for oil, drilling for natural gas and coal and all these natural resources that human beings have learned to harvest and use, as a consequence of that, they have this technology which is very useful in helping people in these emergency situations. So, and I think that Ayn Rand would agree with this, and you can see this, and she has a big focus on the innovation which comes from the creators. And she makes this distinction between the creators, of which these this Colorado company, that you mentioned, the German company which produced the ultra-strong cable which brought them up, and even another American company which makes socks with copper fibers, which prevents foot infections, because I guess there's water, or people don't bathe for a long time. You can actually get really bad foot infections over time, and then you might lose a limb. And so they sent down these socks. And so although this was kind of an international effort, it's the fact that you have all these different countries with specialized different things, that in a situation of free enterprise and free trade, you have these technologies which can help people when they're in need, and that often governments, which don't produce anything but just they claim to control things for the common good, and unions, which are also sort of no friend of Ayn Rand, that they often get in the way of people being helped. And that was the point there. So no, thoughts on this and on... How does this fit in with this idea of the creators versus the... talk about the creators for a minute. Who does Ayn Rand mean by the creators? Trish is talking about scientists, industrialists, inventors, but also artists. And in this speech from Howard Roark, so Howard Roark is this character from Fountainhead. And actually, you can read the book's fairly long. Maybe it's a good read. It's actually pretty entertaining. But it's rather long. You can see the movie. They made a movie with, I think, Gary Cooper, which actually is pretty good. What's her name? The actress who played the lead just died a little while ago. I can't think of her name. In The Fountainhead, the main character, Howard Roark, is this architect. And he designs this low-income housing project. And he has some novel ideas about the efficient use of space, about a way to build this housing complex to keep the costs down and to give people a place to live. Now the question is, why does he want to do this? Well, it's because he's an architect. What does he like to do? He likes to design things. And he, what's important to him, his values, are seeing his designs realized. And so he partners with this company and he says, I will give you my designs, which will save you money and allow you to build this in the budget you have. My only condition is that you don't change my designs at all. You make them exactly to specification. And I'll give you these designs for $1, I think. Or maybe it was nothing. It was either a dollar or nothing. So essentially, he's giving away his designs, but on the condition they don't change them. What happens is this group reneges on the contract. They change his design to make it into some monstrosity that's just horrible and completely different from his design. It's going running over cost, and it's not his vision. And so they've destroyed what he sees as almost his work of art. So what does he do? He goes out there with a bunch of dynamite and blows it up. And now he's on trial, and the section in The Fountainhead is his defense in court. With the charges of destroying this housing complex. Now, Ayn Rand would say, when a person does something like this, are they motivated out of the goodness of their heart? You think about inventors and scientists and industrialists. Are they just going out trying to help people? No, that's what the do-gooders do. And what the do-gooders want to do is they want to take your money and my money and use it to help the people they think should be helped. Often people that really could help themselves. And they don't produce something. They just want to redistribute what is produced by the producers, the creators, the productive businesses, the employers. And they want to take that money and dole it out to people that didn't earn it, who they consider to be deserving. And what the creators do is that out of their acts of creation, they provide technology and goods and services and things that people use that they buy on a voluntary basis. And that benefits society as a whole. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, the way Ayn Rand presents this. And Howard Roark essentially says, look, it was my design. They broke my contract. And then he goes into this long speech about other things, about the nature of the creator in contrast with the second-hander. The parasite. The altruist. Thoughts, Blake?
What would you say about public universities funded by tax dollars that are at the forefront of technological and medical innovation? Is there definitely, I don't get to choose where my tax money goes. I don't have a choice to pay taxes, but they're going to the universities, and they're creating things. What would you say about that?
Yeah, I think, someone have a thought on that? Actually, I don't want to answer. I'll see if someone else might want to answer that. Yeah.
The innovations that are most often come from universities that are funded by corporations and corporate interests. So you know, it is.
There is some underwriting. Sure, I mean, I think you make a good point that much much of the universities are funded by the government, and also you have the National Science Foundation and all these governmental groups that fund research which sometimes comes up with major innovations. Evan?
Maybe an argument would be, rather than giving it to those who didn't earn it, you're loaning it to someone who will produce more than what you've invested in. And so rather than redistributing wealth, you're investing wealth into something that will produce more wealth.
Yeah, but it's still being done sort of in a forcible way.
Yeah,
you're taking
choice, tax dollars.
I think one thing you could say, look at the space program. The space program paid a lot of dividends in terms of expanding scientific knowledge, and also things like expanding dramatically computers and our understanding of physics, and just all, there's all sorts of dividends paid by the space program, and advances in computing is one of the major ones pointed to. But if you look at the amount of money that went into the space program, and you think if you throw enough money at anything and put enough people on the payroll, enough smart people, you're going to get some results. But the operative question, it seems to me, is if that money went into the hands of a private company, would they have had better results? The same thing with science. You look at the number of scientific research, and I mean, you read this stuff in the paper all the time, right? There was some, I can't remember, these studies where people, they studied the reproductive habits of like tree frogs and these bat guano and some obscure species of insect and the economics of transgender prostitutes in Thailand. I mean, just all kinds of crazy stuff, which is a very little practical value, just millions of dollars being shelled out to all manner of studies that if you asked your average person in the street, would you want to pay for this? They'd say, no way in hell I would pay for that. And so if all that money went to things like... you look at like the funding for AIDS, for example. AIDS is like a big sort of political disease. Interesting, huge amounts of money that goes into AIDS research, and you compare that with the amount that goes into cancer research, research on heart disease, and other things which affect many, many more people. It's a disproportionate amount goes into AIDS research, and that's a fact. That's produced by the fact that the government controls this, and because there's sort of the political lobby, which is lobbying for AIDS funding, and so it gets a disproportionate amount of the research money, leaving very little left for cancer and heart disease and so on. Yeah.
By the theory that the government should be staying out of that, though, doesn't it, that money sort of come out of the equation, the amount of money that private industry is spending on researching things like cancer and heart disease and AIDS, et cetera, it seems in some cases drug companies are investing more money than the government, in some cases they're investing less. It just seems like the differential is made up by government and vice versa in the current system.
Yeah, it's are you saying that the money that money that the government spends is money that private industry doesn't have to invest? Or are you saying that the government... Okay, yeah. So it's kind of... Think about like the... I don't know. Let's get somebody else in here. So yeah, you have to...
Two things. Like without the government, there would be no space program because simply there is no industries big enough to actually undertake what has to be given. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars. There's no industry, no group of interesters who would ever donate that much money in space program, especially.
Well, you're not donating the money. I mean, think about the payoff. Like,
well, but there is not. It's too big. It has to be done by the government.
Why would you say that?
What happened? Because of the amount of money it takes, there's no industries which can actually support a NASA program outside of the government. Not oil. I mean, full oil industry, all their profits together is a drop in the bucket compared to what NASA is.
Well, over time, there's actually, private space flight is just getting started, and government has to make room for it. The reason there hasn't space flight before is because there's a government monopoly on it.
But right now, it's started, but it's still not even a drop compared to the actual.
There's a lot of rich people that would pay to go into space. You can have space tourism. There's plans for a space station. All you need to do is gather enough capital and have a long-range enterprise and have the technology to do it, too. Now, might space flight have been delayed a certain period of time? Maybe we wouldn't have gotten it early. Maybe. But then, you might argue that all that money that went into space flight, maybe that might have improved other things, right? That might have created other technological innovations. Because anytime you siphon resources out of society, there's a question about where would those resources have done had you not directed them in this direction. Look at the housing bust, for example. So we had all these government policies which funneled money into housing, artificially propping up the price. The bubble gets bigger and bigger, and it feeds on itself until eventually it bursts, and then you have all these negative consequences. And the question is, what would have happened if instead of being funneled into housing through government policy, it would have been funneled into other things? With people making free choices about what to do with their money. And you wouldn't have had this crazy bubble effect. And so you can't look at things in isolation.
It seems like this argument doesn't work also on the basis that private industry hasn't stepped up to make that. They've tried sort of. There's a couple of private industry companies that have worked for the government grant for spaceships, but there's no legal monopoly on spaceflight. Obviously, there can't be, because if nothing else, there's at least three countries that are paying for it right now.
I think there's international treaties on space, and there's a number of legal hurdles.
Yeah,
and you need the government's permission to do it. And beforehand, it's been very difficult for people who want private space flight. You need to get, if you're in the United States, you need NASA's approval. And the United States having history of being a free market country and therefore being technologically advanced and economically vibrant is one of the few countries capable of it. But that the current government, is reticent to give up the government's control and regulation of space too.
But at the same time, no companies have really bought on to Bird of Tan's design, for example. Again, it's something that I'm actually interested in. But in terms of spaceflight, there is a model for low-cost privatization that is sanctioned by the United States government. And as it stands, if you're an American and you want to go into space, you have to talk to Russia or China.
Yeah, and I think that there's some of that issue, I would say, some of that's due to regulation. There's space tourism in Russia now, and you have the X Prize for spacecraft that's given for new innovations in space travel. But maybe the space program's overrated. If people really want to go into space, people will invest in space travel. How about other comments about Ayn Rand's description of the creator and the mindset of the creator? And also the sort of her description of the second-hander, the parasite. The person who doesn't produce anything, but rather is focused on developing connections and being sort of politically connected and getting a hold of resources. And she talks about the people who become not masters of nature, but masters of men. So you take... The creator is a master of nature. He learns to harness the power of fossil fuels, of technology, of energy, and learns how nature works and learns to harness it for human welfare. And you have the second-hander who takes that and just wants to sort of skim off the top, right? Through taxation, through unions, and through political pressure, they take away from the creator and want to sort of distribute the income out. Whereas, as Rand's view is that when you let the market do its thing, you let people decide who they're going to work for, how much they're willing to work for, you let businesses buy, sell, trade, and invest as they see fit, there's lots of jobs, and there's lots of good jobs. And when you allow free trade, you allow countries that and industries that specialize in certain things to do their thing, to exchange value for value, and then you have people benefit. So if you have, like, for example, they talked about the Netherlands. The Netherlands is really good at cleaning up oil spills. They're this seafaring country. They've got this really good technology for dealing with oil spills. What did the United States do? They had like a bunch of ships that are going to send over here. Again, altruistic? Well, maybe, but there's this idea that, you know, people kind of work together, but it's not force, it's not coercion. So it's not like Ayn Rand says you should never help anybody. It's that you shouldn't use force and coercion and coercive institutions to make people do things. And so the Dutch, because the Dutch actually have sort of a history, maybe it's a long, long time past, but of also of sort of trade and of capitalism. But so the Dutch have all these ships, and they say, well, we'll give you our ships, and you can clean up this oil spill. And the United States says, nope, sorry, so we have union rules, and there's American jobs, we've got to protect those jobs. And the oil's gushing, and they have all this equipment, which is really good at taking the oil out, and we're refusing them as the oil piles into the Gulf. And that sort of view is kind of short-sighted, although you think, well, we'll protect us and ours. In the long term, that can be detrimental to you because you don't have access to all these different technologies. And I think it was interesting that Dan Henninger pointed to all the different elements of this Chilean rescue, from the drill bit in Colorado to the German cable to some of, I think, the electronics that they used to communicate with the miners came from the Japanese. There's a fiber optic cable they dropped down there. And so when people have these things at their disposal, which are produced by market economies and evil corporations, they're able to help people in need. Whereas you look at like the countries in Latin America, which are mostly socialist, were they offering something to help there? No, because they don't have any fancy fiber optic cables. You have most of the countries in Latin America are largely subsistence farming with people living in dire poverty. Yeah.
One of the things about both those disasters were in part caused by shortcuts taken, and like the mine conditions were horrible, caused the collapse, the blowout preventer wasn't right.
Uh-huh, sure.
So it was that free market drive for more money and the cutting corners that created these things. So it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, so there's the counter argument is like, who was, why did you have this gold oil spill in the first place? And why was the mining collapse in the first place? Evan?
Well, I would say that it's just bad business practice. I mean, it's obviously in the best interest of this company to protect their workers and make sure that nothing goes wrong, because if something goes wrong, then they won't make money. Cutting corners might save money in the short term, but in the long term, it's bad business practice.
The other thing is that they think about safety awards. Right? The platform that blew up in the Gulf actually got a safety award the year before. I'm thinking to myself, why are they spending time and energy on safety awards? You know, that seems like a stupid way to regulate. And they passed with flying colors. And so you look at that and you think, well, this idea of more government inspectors, is that really going to help things out? Is it the fact that they didn't have enough safety inspectors? And also, stuff happens, right? Mistakes happen and human beings are fallible. You're never going to prevent accidents 100%. Are you going to stop using oil? Are you going to stop driving your car? Yeah.
Part of that second-hander, too, it's like the miners all got together and said, hey, we're going to sell our story for $20 million. And get the second-hander or the parasites to come in and say, hey, well, let's negotiate this deal with them because we're going to make, $63 million on a movie, portraying these 33 miners. They'll all make money. We'll make money.
And that, I think, just seems to be people have something of value and they want to sell it. And they're going to actually turn out to come out really well on this. But I think Rand would call those people as being, I don't think she would call them second-handers because they're not, you know, they have something of value that they're trading. And people want to hear the story of the miner. It's big news. And so they're just taking advantage of their opportunity. And she would say there's nothing necessarily wrong with that. And people that want to produce a movie based on the story they think they can sell to people that want to see in the theaters, everybody wins. Yeah?
In response to the oil spill comment, I do believe that it's government regulation, in particular, the reason that we had to drill out so far in the first place. If we were able to drill in closer, this would have been much easier to clean up. It wouldn't have been 5 miles out, or 5 miles down, however deep it is. We could have handled it much easier. And also, I do believe that there is a government oversight that signed off on the drilling of that actual platform.
Mm-hmm.
So to say that it was capitalism and the evil dollar that drove this company into the thing to bust, the government signed off. They made them drill off that farm.
And then for no particular reason, you have the government, you know, the Obama administration, shutting down all of these oil rigs. And these oil rigs are going to be moved to other countries where they're going to produce oil. And you even have the administration lending money to a Brazilian company to drill out there in the Gulf too, which is crazy. So American companies can't do it. And this all has to do with this political connectedness, right? So you have people that are sort of making campaign donations, people who are friends of the administration. You have George Soros is got a big stake in Petrobras. So you get the stuff that goes on behind the scenes, it affects how the resources are distributed, and sometimes it can affect like how the regulators act and whether the regulators crack down on someone who's doing something dangerous or not. If they if you pay enough money, the regulators will look the other way. Yeah.
And also, I just pulled it up because I was curious about it, but it seems like the arms, which was the equipment from the Netherlands, were delivered at the request of the government by the Dutch Corps of Engineers. So it was another public institution of a foreign government that actually did give those to us. And we transported them out on the American ship.
But how long did that take? Like, it was like 30 days after the spill.
Yeah.
But they were offering it like within a couple of days of when the spill started.
But they didn't come from private industry.
Right, so the Dutch government was actually sending those over, and they're part of a Dutch corps. The Dutch have this deal where if a private company doesn't clean up their spill in something like 48 hours, they send out their private corps. Yeah, but I think that's a fair point. One other thing on the oil spill was I read a story about how, you know, Louisiana, they're sending out people to skim the oil, and the Coast Guard was coming out there and sending out these ships, which were sent out by the governor, back because they didn't have the proper safety equipment. And there was one guy, he had like, you know, this oil skimmer, and the Coast Guard comes aboard and says he doesn't have enough life jackets in his boat and is like sending him back. And that's the kind of thing the government does, like stupid, short-sighted, obsessive rule following, which not thinking of the bigger picture. They're just thinking, well, here's the rules and here's what we have to do. Yeah.
Well, part for that is because since you're operating under the government payment and have government umbrella, suddenly government becomes liable if something happens to you. So if the guy drowns like the people drown, they know you in the blues. You're a guy, Captain. This year in the government because it's a government operation now.
Well, it's a private boat.
It's still a government operation.
It was sent by the government. Or it was sent by a government.
So you're still going to pursue the government, not the blues. So you have to be 100% protected of your rules. You have to protect yourself.
Well, that's a ridiculous rule. You have people sign a waiver or something like that.
That'd be nice to see.
Well, I mean, it's another, the lawyers, I think, is another bill in here. Sorry, you had a point.
Well, just like the whole idea of regulation in general, like it doesn't trust in people anymore. It takes like the responsibility away from people to do their own thing and trust in one another and make, you know, work together and make decisions. They put so many rules and regulations on everything that you can't just common sense, you know, be clean up an oil spill, work together, have other countries, you know, volunteers, people go out there and get it done. There's just so many rules and regulations and, you know, back ways and things you have to do. You can't just do what needs to be done anymore. There's just everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it seems pointless because it's like, you know, you're supposed to regulate and make it better, but really it just makes things impossible.
And coming back to like Rand's sort of foundation for what is the foundation of ethics, she says it's sort of the survival and life. And it's the life principle, what is it that human beings are fundamentally? Human beings are rational animals. This goes back to Aristotle. So we're rational animals, and we use our minds to survive. The mind is the source of our survival flourishing. And so when she thinks about the creator is the person who uses their mind to create something which never existed before, to create a productive business, to create a work of art. And she makes a point through Howard Wark that if you look at the innovators, the people that brought about dramatic changes to society, people that invented things and produced things, that in their time they were shunned by the majority, ridiculed, scoffed at, until people sort of finally came around. So the innovators in society are typically going against what the masses want and what the masses think they should do. And they tend to be individualists who have the power to go against the collective and have their vision of the future, which eventually wins out, but there's this lag. And typically, they're fighting against the masses of society who oppose them at every turn. And so she thinks that the values that we ought to have in society is that the creators and the producers ought to be respected. Society ought to let them do their thing, and then they naturally produce things of value to other people without using force or fraud. And that's the ideal society, a society where things are done on a voluntary basis, where there's prosperity and abundance based on people producing and achieving and competing, as opposed to having some central authority which takes from people and then redistributes on the basis of how connected you are or what some authority decides you deserve. Thoughts? Anything in particular in the Rand reading that struck anybody? Yeah.
Well, it wasn't just about that, but about the regulation thing and this. Like, having so many regulations on things seems like it makes it harder for people to flourish and go back to their just survival skills of life. You can't just live your life anymore the way that, you know, we are. There are our natural way, you know. Rational animals using your mind. You can't do that anymore because there's so many regulations. There's so many restrictions.
Sure. And you just look at, we have this thing where we have to come up in our department, just a very small example, with the hazardous materials list. Now, it's an office, right? What do we got in there? We got these pens, don't stick this pen up your nose and go like that, or it's going to be bad for you, right? This is actually even a non-toxic thing. We have a paper cutter. You got to be careful with it. It's got a little guard there. But we have somebody spent time and energy producing a list of hazardous materials and the safety manuals that nobody looks at. I don't even think we've had a fire drill here in the last time I can remember. And so there are all these basically people that spend all their time working up these rules and trying to figure out how not to get sued instead of thinking about how can they do things better for education. And people that run educational institutions spend a lot of time trying to figure out how do we avoid lawsuits and how do we save money, and not a lot of time thinking about, or not as much time as they should maybe think about education. And just one other thing about productive businesses. Often, especially large corporations, spend more time trying to figure out how to avoid taxes than they do how to profit more or produce a better product or whether they can plow money into research and development. Because the government takes so much, they think, okay, well, how will this new policy affect our taxes? And the regulations are so complicated. You have meetings which should be spent on marketing, research, development, company policy, innovation, and it's all spent on how do we avoid having more of our money taken away and not be able to post a profit. Yeah.
I think it kind of poses a bit of a problem because, I mean, kind of under the whole idea of, you know, it's impossible to please everybody all of the time. I mean, like, people would say, yes, it's oppressive to, you know, have all of these different safety precautions and being so, you know, OCD about making sure that you follow the rules. But at the same time, you know, if you were to walk into the teacher's lounge and, you know, the floor fell out from underneath you because the building wasn't up to code, you probably have a problem with that. And so it's like nobody wants to be on the complete side where they're 100% accountable for everything they do, but at the same time, they don't want to be told everything that they have to do.
Right. So it would make sense that if you're going to build a building, now the thing is buildings, most people have buildings, they want to have insurance to build in case something happens, right? Is an insurance company going to underwrite the insurance for a building which is shoddily put together? No. Right? So I mean, there are business motivations and prudential motivations for making buildings that don't fall down. But what happens is you have this sort of safety government, safety inspectors and other institutions which step in and give people this false sense of security. And, you know, people think they're going to get a bailout or they think that somebody's going to... There's these government inspectors are making sure everything's safe, and so they pay no attention, and then some disaster strikes and people act as surprised. Yes, sir?
I don't want to say no. I talk about being sued and that kind of thing. I think that's a lot of the problem with what we have going on in our society is that you can get sued for anything that you do. If as a company, for example, doctors, we have this problem with health care being so expensive. Well, doctors have to pay insurance premiums out there. They have to protect themselves from malpractice lawsuits, which happen all the time. Well, they could. I mean, you can't sue everybody for everything. That's the lawyers are what the problem is. And they're the ones making the rules, so they're the ones making all the money. I think that's mm-hmm. where it all stems from, is the lawyers.
Yeah, I think that a lawyer, particularly like a kind of a shady trial lawyer, is what Rand thinks about sometimes when she's thinking about the parasite. Maybe makes a good case there. This main act, she mentions this at the beginning in the excerpt I gave you from her journal, and this is Rand's basic principle: no man exists for the sake of another, and the idea is that you should be free to live your life as you see fit, as long as you don't use force or fraud in another person. And that you don't have an obligation to advance the general interests of mankind. You're not a servant of mankind or a servant of God. You are you're your own person, and you get to decide to live your life according to your own values, and that your only obligation is to respect the values of other people and to not use force or fraud on those people. So what do you think of... So as a version of egoism, what do you think about this? So it's now this is interesting. Right? It's let's put it this way. You should be free. So long as you don't use force or fraud on another person, which restricts their freedom. And this idea that you're a servant of society, a servant of mankind, or even that you hear this phrase people talk about, well, what have you done to give back to society? And this idea of giving back assumes that you've taken something that's not yours and that you owe society something. And Rand would say you don't really owe society anything, and there really is no such thing as society. There's just individuals. society is just any, all the individuals that exist in any, at any given time. You're an individual. You live according to your own rules and interests. The only thing you should worry about is you should not use force or fraud on another person and restrict their freedom and liberty. So what do you think about this as a basic principle? Oh, we've got 2 minutes left. 1 minute left. Anyone have a last comment on Rand? Someone want to have the last word? Oh, we'll cogitate on Rand's. We'll look at the reading a little closer on Wednesday, and we're going to get into Hobbes and the social contract on Wednesday. Don't forget, Wednesday's the last time to take the exam. Last day.